From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made on Tuesday in Ohio when former presidential candidate Ben Carson addressed the Florida delegation near the Republican National Convention. He was talking about the transgender community, using phrases such as, quote, the height of absurdity. He compared a transgender person to someone who wakes up in the morning and decides to change his or her ethnicity. His remarks were met with laughter and applause from the delegation. Carson's comments are just a fraction of recent instances of intolerance and discrimination faced by the transgender community. And we could talk about similar examples targeted at Native Americans, Muslims, African Americans, Latinos, the list goes on. It seems we are more polarized and divided than ever. And when we talk about recent hate crimes or terror attacks or mass shootings, we don't need sentences, just single words: Orlando, Turkey, Dallas. But on today's program, we're not talking about what drives us apart. We're talking about how different communities can come together. A little more than 2 weeks from now, people from various genders, religions, and ethnic groups will gather at Ganondagan. It's an event called Breaking Bread, Building Bridges, and the goal is to promote understanding and diversity of thought by sharing personal stories. We'll get a preview of that event today because my guests this hour are the featured speakers. I'd like to welcome them to our studio. Gabrielle Hermosa is a public speaker, a trans woman, human rights advocate, a mentor, and counselor, among other things. Welcome.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here today. Thank you.
Lauren Jimerson is from the Seneca Nation, the Heron Clan, and she's an art therapist and a fine artist. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Mubarak Bashir is the Director of Faith Outreach for the Rochester Chapter of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And Meg Joseph is the Executive Director of Friends of Ganondagan. Welcome, Meg.
Thank you for having me.
I want to tell our listeners, we were having a great conversation before we got the hour started, and I know that will continue into this hour. There's a lot of love in this room right now, and I hope you feel it through the airwaves at home. We'll be hearing Gabrielle, Lauren, and Mubarak's stories throughout the hour, but I want to start with Meg. And just talking about this event in general, how did this Breaking Bread, Building Bridges event come to fruition?
Sure. So I'm the executive director at Friends of Ganondagan, and we're a not-for-profit organization that supports Ganondagan State Historic Site. And really what we do is we promote the message of peace, and we do that through our innovative and transformational programming, and we share programming that really reinforces things like social justice, democracy, women's rights, food sovereignty, and sustainability. And this program really came about because I had the good fortune of seeing Gabrielle and Mubarak part of the Human Book Project, and I was with my teenage daughter. And just as you spoke earlier and talked about what Ben Carson had said, I felt myself choking up, and I could almost cry just that there are so many people out there that just have such hateful thoughts. And my daughter and I, we literally were in tears. And it was just, it took us back to think that that people really thought hateful things about people that they didn't even know. And it really struck me that, it's really all about humanity. And it's really all about meeting somebody and getting to know them and understanding where their heart's at. And if Ganondagan, if we can bring about that sort of a conversation, which is something that we really feel strongly about, that that we can have an effect on one person that might be able to have an effect on another, because it's really hard to have a stereotypical thought about a group if you know somebody personally. And all of a sudden, it makes you pause and say, that's just not right, and that's not true. So that's really our thought and our focus, and that's why I was just thrilled when both Gabrielle and Mubarak and Lauren felt that they could share their stories with our community.
I'm so glad you mentioned the Human Library. I'm a big fan of the Human Library. I've been to several myself. And listeners, if you're not familiar, the Human Library, it's an event in which people act as books. So they come in and readers, quote unquote, check them out, and they spend some time sitting down on an individual basis and getting to know their personal stories. And it came about, I think it was 2001 in Denmark, correct me if I'm wrong, Meg, when a group of young people witnessed their friend being attacked. I think he was stabbed. and they formed a movement called Stop the Violence, and that eventually inspired the Human Library. There have been several locally, and this seems like such a beautiful way to continue that effort at Ganongagan. And I know a few of you have participated, and that's wonderful. And I've been able to see firsthand these beautiful moments happening. A friend of the program, Shauna O'Toole, is a transgender woman. She sat down with a group of grandparents who were trying to understand their grandchild who was transitioning. I think their grandchild was maybe 9 or 10. And she said, it's very humbling when someone comes to you for help, when someone comes to you for that kind of understanding. And I know that that's what people will gain from you, from all of you at this event. And so, Meg, when people who are listening, if they're interested in attending, what will the event look like to them? What should they expect that afternoon?
Sure. So the event is on August 7th, and that's a Sunday. It starts at 2 o'clock, and it's at the Seneca Art and Culture Center at Ganongagan in Victor, New York. And when people come, they'll be able to hear stories from Lauren Jimison, who is Seneca, from Mubarak Bashir, and he is from the Muslim community, and Gabrielle Hermosa, who is a transgender woman. And after they hear their stories and their journeys and about their lives, they'll have the opportunity to sit down with them and really literally break bread. So, you know, where we work, where I am at Ganongagan, it's very important. Food is a very important part of building community. And we share food, we share good food in all of what we do. So it just seemed like a really natural fit to have people share their stories, get to know each other, and get to know each other over a table, and to share maybe their traditional foods. We'll have, you know, cornbread and other foods that might reflect on a person's journey. So.
We're going to get to hear all of your stories very soon, and I'd like to open this up to the community. You can join the conversation by calling 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're here in Rochester, you can call 263-WXXI. That's 263-9994. You can also email the program at connections@WXXI.org, or you can find me on Twitter at MMACMedia. So we welcome your questions and comments. I see the phones are already starting to light up, so we're going to have a busy hour. Gabrielle, I'd like to start with you. I'd like to talk a little bit about your journey. And I spoke to our guests a little before the program started, and I said, feel free to share as much as you're comfortable with. And everyone in this room said there are no questions that are off limits. They're happy to answer any questions because they feel like it will be a benefit in breaking down some of these stereotypes. So, Gabrielle, tell us a little bit about your journey.
So I'm a trans woman, as is abundantly clear now, and my journey started, I'm 46 years old, so my journey started way back in 1970 when I was born, and the doctor looked between my legs and told my parents, congratulations, you have a bouncing baby boy. Wah, wah. Unfortunately, you know, we're assigning, back then and still today, we're assigning gender based on, one's biological anatomy, and we know that gender is not attached to one's biology. Most of the time it does work out like that. However, it doesn't always work out like that. About 0.5% of people are transgender, like myself. And it took me many years. I'm 46 now. It took me a lifetime to really, probably in my mid-30s, when I really started to kind of try to figure out who I really am, what I really am, what is this weird thing inside me, why do I always feel this need to be feminine? And it took me a long time to get to the point where I could feel like I could start to explore that, because growing up in the 70s and the 80s, there was no outlet for this. You know, I knew as a very young child, I was 3 years old, when I would look at other women, and I would, like, wow, look, they wear pretty makeup, and they do pretty things with their hair, and there were these things called go-go boots, and I would say on women, I loved go-go boots. For those of you who are not familiar with go-go boots, just think of Lieutenant Uhura from Star Trek. She had Starfleet issue go-go boots. So I was always attracted to all this femininity, but it wasn't just an attraction to women. I was attracted to the femininity in the sense that I felt that was me. But back in the 70s and 80s, I was told I was a boy. They raised me as a boy. Why would my parents lie to me? Why is society going to lie to me? I must be a boy. There must be something wrong with me. So I would try on my mom's clothes growing up, and they wouldn't fit very well, but I did the best I could, and I was really careful never to get caught doing that. And unfortunately, in 1983, when I was 12 years old, my mother did catch me wearing one of her skirts. And that was really, really a traumatic experience. I remember the date. It was March 12th, 1983. It was a Saturday. I will never forget that day because it was the most traumatic event of my youth. My apologies if I get choked up here and there.
No, please.
I was going to say, I let it come out. This is me. That's what happened to me. And I think it's important that I'm not going to cover that up if it comes out. So that happened, and that was when I started to really learn. You know, I learned to hate myself. There was something terribly wrong with me, or so I thought, so I believed. You know, my mother had, quote-unquote, talk with me, which was very uncomfortable at the time. And I hated myself, and I wanted to die. And I'm like, what do I do? How do I get out? You know, I didn't know. I couldn't do this anymore. I didn't want to live. And over time, I tried to find other ways to feel feminine. So as a teenager in high school, I tried to live vicariously through the girls that I dated and tried to get them to be the way I wanted to be, if only I was allowed to be who I am. And I didn't realize this at the time. I was not conscious of this, but it was a very controlling and manipulative behavior on my part. And when they would break, you know, because here I am, no self-esteem, and I was being controlling and manipulative. And so these relationships would never end well. And when they broke up with me, it wasn't just like losing a lover, losing a friend, a girlfriend, losing a way of life. It was like my only sense of femininity being ripped right out from underneath me. And of course, it was never mine to begin with. And it left me with my masculine self, which I hated. And I, in 1989, when I was a senior in high school on a Tuesday afternoon, in April of 1989, after another breakup, a difficult breakup, I decided I couldn't do this anymore, and I took 80 Somanex sleeping pills, and I laid in my bed to just drift off magically to sleep that I would never awake from. And I didn't drift off magically to sleep. I remained awake the entire time, and the drugs kicked in, and it was a really uncomfortable feeling, and I felt my body shutting down around me, but I didn't fall asleep, and I had second thoughts. I remember the sun shining in my room that afternoon, that Tuesday afternoon in April of 1989. It was like someone was looking in on me saying, what are you doing? You're not supposed to die here today. There's something more for you. And so I had a change of heart and went down. I couldn't walk at this point. I had to plop off the bed, crawl down the stairs, tell my parents what I had done. And they rushed me off to the hospital, and they pumped my stomach and stick a tube up my nose and down my throat, pump a stomach. It was very uncomfortable, but I was very thankful. I survived that, and I was very, very lucky because there was no permanent damage done by that. I could have, been permanently brain damaged, lost the ability, mobility. I might have lost the ability to communicate. So really, really, really lucky that day. And I'm counting my blessings. But even so, that bought me a four-month stay in a psychiatric hospital, New Canaan, Connecticut. It's called Silver Hill, the psychiatric hospital. I believe it's still there today. And while I was there, I couldn't tell anyone what was going on. I let them think I'm just a suicide little teenage, quote-unquote, boy who couldn't deal with breakups. I let them believe that just so because I didn't want them to, quote-unquote, know how messed up I really was, and I didn't want them to try and, quote-unquote, fix me. Like, I didn't want them to take this away. So I went through the program, got back 4 months later, and I lived in Brockport at the time. My friends all welcomed me back, and then they all vanished from my life. Some had to go back to high school, some went off to college, some just were really creeped out by the fact that I tried to harm myself and didn't want to be a part of my life. So that left me being miserable as myself with my parents, and so I took it on my family, and they couldn't take it, and they kicked me out. And they did help me find a place to live, but in 1989, I was 18 years old, living on my own, and I had to go get a job and figure out what to do. And the cycle would repeat. You know, I'd date women, and they'd break up with me, and it was like my only femininity being ripped out from underneath me. I did hook up with a really beautiful, wonderful woman in 1991. She was a little bit older, and she wasn't freaked out by the fact that I had tried to harm myself. And so a relationship started in 1991, and in 1995, I made her my wife. I did not share with her before getting married that I'm transgender. One, I didn't know what transgender meant in 95. It was before the internet. For those of you listening, life before the internet, if you don't have any memory of that, I'll paint a quick picture. We used to all live in caves, and you used to have to dodge dinosaurs when you left your cave. And if you wanted to stop the car, you had to put your feet through the bottom of the car, your bare feet through the bottom of the car, just like Flintstones. So I joke, of course, but it was like the Stone Ages in the many respects because there was no free flow of information. You couldn't just look up, what does this mean? What's going on? And I wasn't going to go to the library and out myself trying to figure it out. So 95, I got married, did not tell my wife. I thought it was going to go away. It didn't. Of course, it doesn't go away because it's not what I do. It's who I am inside. Many years later, the internet happened. I do a lot of soul searching and research. I, for a while, thought I was a cross-dressing man. And I came out to my wife in 2009 as a cross-dresser, and it actually went really well. She was really supportive. She bought clothes with me. She did my makeup for the first time. And it was a really beautiful, it really helped our marriage a lot. But the problem is I never wanted to go back to being a boy afterwards. So over, a couple more years go by, I do some more soul searching, I went out to meet other transgender people, and that's when I realized, oh my God, I'm not, I'm not a cross-dressing man, I'm a transgender woman. And this was really scary because as a cross-dresser, I was keeping it pretty secretive. You know, I had a website that I was blogging on and trying to raise awareness. I'm like, stop calling cross-dressers freaks. You know, the cross-dressers really are one of the most misunderstood segments of the population. But so I'm a trans woman, I need to live authentically. But that unfortunately meant I get to come out to my wife a second time, which I did in 2013, just a few years ago, and that did not go so well. She does not consider herself a lesbian. I actually am a transgender lesbian. Yes, we do exist. I welcome questions on that, if I'm sure there are a few. So that didn't go well. We still live together, and she's still supportive in some ways and unable to be supportive in other ways, and I love her with all my heart, and I apologize to her almost daily for hiding this, and I tell her that I will always love her, whatever she chooses to do. If she needs to be with somebody else, I'm not going to say no. I have a contract. I mean, marriage certificate. You know, I'm not going to play that. She's free to do what she wants with whomever she wants because she has the right to be happy. And this is, I own this. This is my fault. I should have disclosed this, even if I didn't have the words. So we're working on this. We kind of live more as I guess roommates or housemates. You know, we still have a home together. The love is there, but there's no more romance. And I love her dearly, and I'm hopeful for the future. I started my own business last year, Amarestvia LLC. It's just an LLC that I operate under. I'm a public speaker. I do a lot of volunteer work, and I'm also a professional public speaker and offer a variety of uplifting and inspirational workshops about transgender, LGBTQ, and just self-improvement. And I'm not sure where my future is going in terms of it's insanely expensive to physically transition, especially those of us who transition later in life. We're looking at about $100,000 for the physical transition, which I very much want to do and need to do to keep my sanity. And none of it's covered by medical insurance, at least not by my medical insurance. So I don't know how I'm going to accomplish this and many other challenges, social and personal challenges in life, but I'm a silver lining girl and I'm always going to look for the silver lining. The challenges that life brings me, I welcome, and they will help me to grow and learn. And hopefully I will open a few hearts and minds along the way and, you know, learn a lot more and open my own heart and my mind in the process.
I want to thank you for sharing all of that. I know it has to be difficult to try to relive those moments sometimes, especially what happened when you were a teenager. Do you have a good relationship with your family now? Do they understand what you've gone through?
That's a really great question. Yeah. So when I was 12, my mom busted me, and I hated her at the time for finding that out. And our relationship went south. And I was never close with my family growing up. Felt like you've heard of like the black sheep. Well, I was the black sheep of black, you know. If there's an extra degree there, I was more than just the black sheep. I did not fit in with my family. I mean, even remove gender from the mix. I just didn't fit in growing up with my family or extended family. So I did come out to my mother. I had been pulling myself away from my family, just kind of distancing myself from them as I started to, you know, take measures to live more authentically. My assumption was, well, you know, they never were really that supportive of me growing up. They didn't get me. They didn't know what to do with me. So why am I going to bother? Because it's very common for transgender people to be rejected by their families and their friends as they come out or get discovered. And so I had been withdrawing, but something made me. It was actually a public speaking event that I did at a local high school. It was Marion. That's not exactly. Well, I guess it's kind of local. So I went to speak there and was with two other speakers, a gay man and a lesbian woman, and cisgender, meaning not transgender gay man, not transgender lesbian. And we were talking about our coming out stories, and I was so moved by that experience and their stories and the way the students reacted to us. They just lit right up because they were getting the underlying, more important message of be who you are and self-empowerment, which is, you know, always my underlying message for everything. And so I called up my mom. I said, Mom, I'd like to come over and talk with you about some things that I told you are going on in my life, but I was very vague about. I'm going to look a little different. So try not to freak out or anything. I went to visit her, and it was a difficult talk at first. And I opened the door, and it's like, surprise, are you surprised? She's like, no. So is it because of March 12th, 1983? She goes, wow, I don't remember the date, but I know what you're talking about. And it took a little while. There were some tears involved, and the conversation concluded with, she told me I always wanted to have a daughter. And I'm like, here, because I have a brother, no sisters. It's like, here I am, Mom. And it was a very positive experience. And my stepfather, my parents divorced the year after I got married in 90. My parents divorced in 96, but they're both with people who are better off for them. So my stepfather came in toward the tail end of when I was coming out to my mom, didn't recognize me. And so I said, do you know who I am? And it took him a moment to figure it out. And I said, yeah, please refer to me as Gabrielle. And he was just immediately like, Gabrielle, I am so happy for you. And he just came up and gave me a big hug. And he's been so supportive and so kind. And my mom, too. She actually, I do a lot of safe zone training with the Gay Alliance, LGBTQ Academy at the Gay Alliance. And my mother is actually now a volunteer with the Gay Alliance now. She was so inspired and she wanted to get out and make a difference. And she felt so bad about the way she treated me when I was younger, not understanding this. And I'm like, well, I was doing the best that, you know, I could with what I had to work with back then. And so were you. So, you know, and I forgive her and I love her and we have a much better relationship as a result. My brother lives in Seattle, other side of the country. When I came out to him, it was through email. His response was, thank you for sharing this with me. And what can I do? How can I be supportive? So he was immediately wanting to be supportive. And I really, really appreciated that. My father is a pastor in his local community. And we didn't get along so well growing up, and his church that he's pastor at has a decree against LGBTQ people, unfortunately. And I want to make it very clear that that's unique to their church. And I know it's not unique to their church, period. I know some churches are like that. But there's a misconception that it's religion or churches versus LGBTQ people, and that's not the reality at all. It's people versus people who they perceive as significantly different or significantly, quote-unquote, undesirable in their opinions. And they fit in reasons to justify that. Well, it's not me. It's God. Yeah, that's the ticket. You know, and arguably some people are raised to believe that when they're young, so they're going to believe that and they're, you know, people take all kinds of religious texts and they say, well, this is what it says, but it really means this, wink, wink, you know, that type of a thing. So I did come out to my father. It was a very civil experience. And we did bat heads a little bit about his religious stance. And I said, well, can I come and talk at your church? He says, well, you can attend it, but we have a decree against LGBTQ people. And I said to him, Dad, do you believe that God is love? And he's like, yes. And I said, where is there room in love for separatism and inequalities and indisparities and judgment? How does that work? And he got really angry with me because he knew immediately there's no argument and there's no counter argument against that. And we had to kind of pull back from that before we, you know, got into a really larger argument. So coming out was a positive experience. That was a couple of years ago. We don't have a relationship now, and I'm okay with that. I love him, I wish him well, but whenever we're in the same room together, it takes him about 30 seconds, you can start the clock, about 30 seconds, 29, 28, before he starts to cast judgment on me and say, well, I can't talk to you because blah, 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 and start to quote the Bible and things of that nature. And I know what he's doing is what he understands to be the right thing. And so I don't judge him negatively for that. And I look forward to maybe someday we can find a way to communicate a little bit better. But is at this point right now, he's not a part of my life. I'm okay with that. Again, we weren't very close growing up. And I'm happier at this point for not having in my life. And, mm-hmm. and I don't know what the future holds. But like I said, I'm an eternal optimist.
You brought up so many great points. And I wish we had more time because I could talk to you for an hour for... Just you brought up, you know, before the age of the internet, there weren't resources. We're still struggling with language with the transgender community. We don't, you know, pronouns. People aren't sure what kinds of pronouns to use. Sometimes they're afraid to ask questions. And these are all things I hope we can get to later in the hour. But I have to take a break right now. So we're going to take our short break, the only break of the hour. And when we come back, we'll hear from Lauren and Mubarak as well, who are also participants in the Breaking Bread, Building Bridges event at Kanonigan. And Dan from Brighton, I saw your call. If you want to give us a call back after the break, we can ask your question to Mubarak. The number here is 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. And we'll be right back after the short break.
I'm Evan Dawson. Coming up in our second hour today, our Summer of Food series of conversations continues with Chef Jeff Caruso. He's worked in the high-end restaurant industry in Manhattan, the Hudson Valley, and more. He came to Rochester, but he didn't retire. He turned his culinary schools to a food kitchen, which has become one of the most in-demand meals in Rochester. And we'll talk about a meal and more next hour.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, filling in for Evan Dawson today. We are talking about the Breaking Bread Building Bridges event coming up at Ganondagan on Sunday, August 7th. And we just heard from Gabrielle Hermosa, who's a transgender woman and human rights advocate, who just shared her very powerful and emotional story about her journey. And I encourage you, if you are just joining us now, the podcast of this hour will be posted later. And I really encourage you to take a listen to it, because this panel, just like the event at Ganondagan, is meant to break down stereotypes and promote understanding. So all of our guests today here are helping us do that. I'd like to turn now to Mubarak Bashir. He is part of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community. And we've had you on the program before talking about your role in the Ahmadiyya Muslim community. But I think there are a lot of people out there who may not know exactly what the community is. So I'd like to spend some time just having you explain how that's different from other parts of the Muslim religion.
I would say the Ahmadiyya Muslim community is no different than other Muslims. Islam, the definition of Islam is obedience and peace, or submission to God, peace with God's creation. We all believe in the six articles of faith, the five pillars of Islam. The one theological difference that we have as members of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community is that the founder of our community, Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, we believe was the Messiah that was promised to come in the latter days. So this is the one theological difference, but if you look at everything else, the way we pray, the other things we do as Muslims is similar to other Muslims as well.
And where are you located?
We are located at 1609 East Main Street.
And I know you said to, when Evan Dawson was interviewing you, I think it was in December of last year, you said you want to talk to people who hate Islam, who hate Muslims, and these are words from the podcast. Why is that? Why do you want to talk to people who feel so strongly against what you believe in?
Because those people don't know me, and they don't know Muslims. There's a survey, 60% of Americans have never met a Muslim. So how can you judge me or any Muslim if you haven't met us? So the people that hate Islam have never met a Muslim. The Muslims that they met are the ones that claim to be Muslim that are on TV killing innocent people. So I think if people that hate Islam meet me, get to know me as a person, then I can change their perception.
I'd like to jump to the phones because Dan in Brighton is back on the line. He has a question for Mubarak. Dan, go ahead.
Oh, actually, he answered the question because you asked it. I wanted to know how the Ahmadiyyas are different from other Muslims, and he answered it. So I thank you. He didn't mention that they are forbidden from going to Mecca, but that's not my problem. Anyway, I am going to hang up and listen to what he has to say.
Thanks, Dan.
I can respond to that. So we are, because of that theological difference, we are considered non-Muslim. Specifically in Pakistan is where it started in the Constitution, that if you're a member of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, if you use the Islamic term of Assalamu Alaikum, which means peace be upon you, you can be sentenced to 3 years in prison. However, that doesn't prevent me. I'm a Muslim. So anyone can say that. The Constitution can say that. In the eyes of God, I'm considered a Muslim. When they say that we're prevented to go to Mecca, we can't go there and pronounce our faith. However, my parents both did make the Hajj, as well as my younger brother. He went as well. So not prevented. They do try to prevent us. If I went and said I'm a member of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community and I tried to make the pilgrimage, then I may be arrested in Saudi Arabia. But again, this goes back to these countries aren't even following the teachings of Islam, where they can judge me and play the role of God, which no one can do. So if I consider myself a Muslim, I'm a Muslim.
You told the story back in December about if you were to try to get a passport in Pakistan, you would have to go through a special process by which you basically deny your faith. So there's discrimination here in the West, and there's discrimination in Pakistan and other Muslim nations. Tell us a little bit about those specific instances where you're targeted everywhere.
Well, for me, I'm an American Muslim. My parents are black and white, so we didn't have to experience that. The large majority of our community here in Rochester have migrated here from Pakistan. And like I said, it is in the Constitution that if you're considered an Ahmadiyya Muslim, you're outside the pale of Islam. So when they go to sign a passport, you have to check a box which says, I believe that the founder of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community is an imposter. If you don't check it, then yeah, I mean you may not get your passport. So basically, they're putting people that may not agree with our theological difference, but don't believe in the persecution, they're putting them in a situation where they have to check this box in order to get that passport. So, I mean, it's just unfortunate when the government plays that much of a role in claiming someone's faith. And again, like I said, this is for minorities in general, not just for Muslims. So I'm speaking out for all minorities in Pakistan and these countries where they can't practice a religion freely, because the founder of Islam, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, fought for all religions. You know, if a church is being attacked, it's my obligation as a Muslim to protect that church, that place of worship.
You've participated in events that are similar to this in the past, and so you've had an opportunity to sit down with people one-on-one and share your story and try to break down stereotypes. What are some of the questions that you get where you can sort of see what the misconceptions are right up front, and how do you tackle those?
I think the main one is the terrorist, is someone killing themselves in the name of Islam. And the best response is there's a verse in the Quran that says, "And kill not yourself." So how can someone take their life when in the Quran, which we believe is the word of God, someone is killing themselves to harm innocent people? No compulsion in religion. For you, your religion, and for me, my religion. These are verses in the Quran that go to show you're free to practice whatever religion you want. No one can force Islam upon you. And again, during the time of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, a lot of people came to Islam because of the compassion that he showed for other people. It wasn't by force or by the sword, which is what some people say. And a lot of these misconceptions that I said is because of what is portrayed in the media. They don't show us having blood drives and saving lives. They don't show us doing interfaith conferences with people of all different religions. Even we had an atheist in one of our interfaith conferences. So they don't show this. They show the violence, which, if you look, a lot of the people that are being killed are Muslims as well. So if this was something that Islam teaches, why are they killing Muslims as well?
And we've had conversations on this program about how the media covers terror attacks. And you see an outpouring of support for attacks in Paris and Brussels and other places in the West. But when you see attacks in countries like Saudi Arabia and Turkey and Bangladesh, sometimes you don't even hear about them. And how does that impact your community? I mean, neglect in itself is a form of discrimination and persecution. How can we overcome something like that?
All life is valuable. So if you give precedence over one attack compared to others, then you're putting someone else's life has more value than a Muslim's life. 74 innocent people were just killed in Syria. They were mistaken for ISIS, women and children. So I mean, but there's no outpouring. There's no... it seems like there's no support for these Muslims that have to live day by day with war, and they're being killed. Innocent Muslims are being killed. When the attacks happened in Iraq, it was like nothing happened. But then when there are other attacks, and I don't condone any attack, regardless of who's being killed, we don't condone any of that. We are against all sorts of violence, but we have to meet on equal ground to show that all life is valuable.
When you sit down with people one-on-one, do you ever get the sense that you can't help them overcome something that may be incorrect?
Again, it's unfortunate that a lot of the times when I sit down with people one-on-one, they're the people that understand Islam. They understand that Muslims aren't like this. It's the ones that don't, that will walk past, yell something, and not sit down and have a conversation. So, I mean, it's the people that hate Muslims so much that don't want to sit down and have a conversation. They'd rather listen again to what they see on Fox News or in the media.
Where does that come from? Is it fear? What do you think is the foundation of that?
It's fear. I think, again, that during the caveman times, as the Gabriel mentioned, we actually sat down and met with people face to face. Now you can just go on your phone and look at social media. No one sits down and has conversations. So it's a little bit of fear. They don't know what to expect. During Ramadan, we had guests come. One person said they have never been to a mosque, but it was just a great experience. So I think we as Muslims, the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, we always keep our doors open for all people. You have nothing to fear but fear itself. If you're afraid of a Muslim, you'll never know that we're peaceful. You know, we're American Muslims just like you. We would die for this country. There are a lot of Muslims that are in the military that would die for the country, the rights that we have.
What do you hope will come of the Ganondagan event? You've done a human library or two or three or four in the past. What makes this event a little different, and what's your goal going into it?
The goal is similar to what makes it. I always say when I go to these events, we have like the pay it forward approach. So if there's one person there that has a dislike for Muslims or some misconceptions about Islam, if I can change their mind, then they can talk to their friends. And this has happened with people that are close to me, you know, that they had some misconceptions. They met us, and they were like, you know, now I'm going to be a defender of Islam because I can see, based on the way that you carry yourself, this is not what we see in the media.
Mm-hmm. Meg, I have to ask you, how did you find these three wonderful speakers for your event?
Yeah, they are wonderful speakers. And, you know, when Mubarak said I'm a defender of Islam, or, you know, just makes me think, I feel like people should be defenders of humanity. You know, we should be out there talking about how wonderful people are. And when you do get to talk to somebody face to face, you really, it changes your whole perspective, and it really makes you want to work hard for social justice. And I think that that's such a big part of Ganondagan. When people come to Ganondagan, one of the things that they say is that they feel they're part of a community. And I've had the good fortune of knowing Lauren for 3 years now, and she's so generous with sharing her stories and sharing what it was like, you know, coming from, you know, Seneca Nation, you know, a nation within a nation, and how many people don't get to experience or understand or learn about that. And so, you know, when I met Mubarak and Gabrielle at the Penfield Library, I was just so taken back. And when I came back and I spoke with our program director, Jeanette Miller, who's Mohawk, she was, you know, so, I guess, moved by their stories. And she immediately it resonated with her and immediately reflected on what we do and what we try and do at Ganondagan. And really, it's about building bridges. And the more people know that, you know, for us, it's, you know, who are the Seneca and Haudenosaunee people? And the fact that, you know, that Native Americans are not a monolithic culture, that they're, you know, 500 plus, you know, tribes or nations with it just in the United States, not to mention indigenous people around the world, and that they're contemporary people, that they're a living, breathing culture doing wonderful things, and that people maybe don't know about that. And it's the same thing with other communities, whether you're talking about the Muslim community or a transgender community or a deaf community. I mean, these are people that, you know, you need to really pause and say, what don't I know?
It's an important question. And as we were talking about earlier, sometimes people are afraid to ask it, and it comes all from fear. And we'll talk to Lauren in just a second about her story. But before we do that, I'd like to take one more phone call. This is Marie in Brighton. Hi, Marie.
Hello. I would like to ask you this question. Just like as if there are bad Christians and good Christians, so it's the same thing with us, with Muslims. We do have bad Muslims and we have good Muslims. And the ones who are bad Muslims are the ones that commit such horrific acts that everybody in the world hates them. These are bad Muslims. They want to call themselves Muslim, and they may be in some area, but they are not good Muslims.
Okay, thanks, Marie. Mubarak, what do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I agree. There's a quote that says, Islam is perfect, people aren't, Muslims aren't. And that goes to show with what the caller had just said. And again, things can't be escalated when it's someone that, there are people that have claimed to be Christian that have committed acts of terror. It seems like once the person's name is mentioned, then it's considered a terror attack. And if their name is Mubarak Bashir and they commit an act, then they would be considered a terrorist. However, if their name is John, then it's just a disturbed individual. Anyone that would take innocent lives has mental issues, and it needs to be addressed. We can't put everyone against Muslims, because then this creates something for the youth. Our goal in our community is, we have a youth group where we try to make sure that our youth are engaged in different things. We go to churches and feed the homeless. So you have to keep them engaged. But if they're not engaged and they're watching what they see in the media, they're thinking that it's us versus them, and that's not it's not true. That's just not the way that our society is. We're all inclusive.
That's so true. And Marie, thank you so much for that phone call, because that really seems like it's a great theme for the event in Canandaigua and this conversation in general. You can't use a group of people as your perception of each individual person within that group. And it happens so often because, well, it's convenient sometimes, and we don't take the time to sit down with people individually and have a dialogue. And that's why today's conversation, I think, is so valuable. I'd like to turn to Lauren Jimerson now. You are from the Seneca Nation, the Heron Clan, mm-hmm. and you grew up on an Indian reservation south of Buffalo. And yes. I was reading a little bit about your story, and you said that as a Native American youth, you're living two different lives.
Yes.
Please share a little bit about your story growing up.
Okay. So it is often that you hear, you know, someone who's Native say that we live in two worlds. And I guess a way to kind of really explain that is there's a wampum belt called the Two-Row Wampum. And that's actually an agreement between the Haudenosaunee people, the Confederacy, or the Iroquois Confederacy, and the American government. And that agreement is that, you know, these are two, well, let me explain the belt. The belt is, wampum beads are purple and white. And so what the belt is two rows of purple and then three rows of white. And the purple rows are between the white rows. So that's why it's called the two-row wampum. And so the agreement is that, you know, these are two different rivers or streams of water. And, you know, we're in a canoe and they're on the boat. And so, you know, we'll stay in our canoe if you stay in your boat, with the understanding that sometimes, you know, someone will get out of their canoe and get into the boat and go back, and vice versa, you know. So there is a sort of like dichotomy living, you know, dichotomous living. And, you know, I always talk about how, you know, I think I'm really old school in certain ways. You know, we still hold to our ceremonial traditions back home on the reservation. And, you know, there's a point where like the Seneca language is dying, but we're trying to revive it because that's the heart of our culture. But at the same time, you know, like Meg said, we are contemporary people. You know, I get asked a lot, well, not so much anymore, but I used to be asked, you know, do you live in a teepee? You know, things like that. And, you know, that kind of idea that, you know, the Native American is a vanishing race or a race that doesn't exist anymore. You know, it's what my mission is to try and, you know, sort of abolish that thought or that idea. You know, and other questions are, you know, I used to get asked all the time, are you Asian, or, you know, are you Hispanic? And, you know, it's because Native Americans don't exist, then, you know, there's no way to identify who I am. So I guess that's all kind of part of it. You know, it's like being old and ceremonial and traditional while still being current and contemporary person. So that's what it is like being in two worlds. You always have these two trains of thought.
Let's turn to representation in the media, because mm-hmm. I did some research for all of the groups we're talking about today, and I think I had pulled a clip from Walt Disney's Peter Pan. I don't think we're going to have time to play it today, but just to describe it a little, there are the Lost Boys and Peter Pan and Wendy and Michael and John, mm-hmm. and they go meet the Native American characters in the film, and they sing a song called What Makes the Red Man Red. Mm-hmm. And you hear words like savages and other words that, and this is a kid's movie.
Yes.
And that's what I took away from all this, is young people who have no other way to find a way to make this, to prove that this stereotype is inaccurate, are watching this film mm-hmm. that is, you know, a very loved film in the world today. And it must be hard. And I know you have kids yourself.
Yes.
Have they seen this film? Have they seen other films like it? There are so many instances out there, cartoons and Westerns. I mean, how does it feel to see yourself represented in that way on the screen?
I'm glad you brought that up, because I actually did do a presentation on this recently. And, you know, you asked if my kids have seen it. Well, when my my older son was younger, you know, we let, well, then he was a female, and we let her watch it. And, you know, she loved Peter Pan. And I don't, you know, at that point, like, it didn't really, you know, dawn on me, or, you know, didn't bother me. But it was like when I started to kind of learn, like, be out in the world more and learn things, and I realized, like, you know, like, wow, these representations are actually very hurtful. And my younger son, I don't know. I just remember, like, my daughter watching it, and then I became disgusted, and I was like, you know, like, this is wrong. And that's when I kind of started thinking about those things. So, my son wasn't really into it. But, you know, I actually do use Peter Pan as one of my examples. I did a talk on how these images, you know, like, affect our development, and these ideas, you know, that we kind of have of ourselves. And, you know, I use Princess Tiger Lily as an example because, you know, it also speaks about, like, feminism too, and what it's like to be a Native American woman. And, you know, I've said that it's dangerous to be a female, but it's even more dangerous to be a Native female. You know, if you've ever heard about the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women in Canada, there's about 1,000 unsolved cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women. And so, you know, I grew up thinking that I had to be like Princess Tiger Lily. And if you think about it, you know, she was used as kind of like this sex symbol, and, you know, kind of, you know, did the sexy dance for Peter Pan in that scene when they're singing that song, and, you know, and then they're kind of touching noses and stuff. And, you know, and I started to think about it more recently, and I was like, you know, well, our women in Haudenosaunee culture are revered as these kind of strong pillars of the family. And, you know, we're title holders within, you know, like, our communities. We have clan mothers. And so, we're told by our mothers and our grandmothers to be strong women. But then in the media, you know, you see something like that. And so it's very confusing, you know, to be like this strong woman. But then, you know, also the dominant culture is kind of placing this idea on you that, you know, you're supposed to be subservient and, you know, stuff like that. So
we're down to our last few minutes. We have one more person on the line. I want to try to work that call in. Robert from Shreveport, we got to be super quick, about 30 seconds.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I think that there's an interesting book out there called The Clash of Civilizations by Samuel Huntington that talks about some of the perceptions versus reality for Islam and Muslims. And I think there's some interesting stats in here. At the time the book was written, which would have been the mid-90s, Muslims were participants in about half of all ethno-political conflicts in the world at that point. There's some other stats there about the propensity to resort to violence in international crises. These statistics need to be updated in the book, but, you know, part of the reason people may be apprehensive about Islam is this propensity to have bloody conflicts with neighboring societies.
Thanks, Robert. Mubarak, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would say if you look at the life of the Prophet Muhammad during his time, the wars were strictly defensive battles. Even the Quran, it says you can only defend yourself. You can't be the aggressor, to the point where as soon as that person desists, you must desist. And if you continue to, if you're the aggressor, you're going against the teachings of Islam. So I think when we look at anything that has to do with what you see today, what I would suggest for everyone listening is read the life of the Prophet Muhammad. If you see someone that considers to be a Muslim that is going against his life, you can read it by Karen Armstrong, who was a Catholic nun. That way you aren't getting a biased opinion on his life from a Muslim. But if you see anything from his life and what people are doing that claim to be Muslim, if it contradicts, that person's not following Islam, because that is the perfect guide for a Muslim to follow. And again, if you look at the history, all battles were defensive in nature, and that's really what you have to look at. As a Muslim, you cannot be the aggressor.
We are almost out of time for this hour, and I wish we had 2 hours instead of just the one. But if you are listening to this program and you'd like to hear more about our guests, or if you have questions for our guests, you have an opportunity to sit down with them in person on August 7th at Ganondagan. Meg, before we run out of time here, where can people find more information?
Sure. You can go to the website, ganondagan.org, or this weekend, in fact, we're having our dance and music festival at Ganondagan. So if you come to our festival, you can talk to me or other people.
Great. Thank you. I'd like to thank my guests today, Meg Joseph, Gabrielle Hermosa, Lauren Jimerson, and Mubarak Bashir. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing your stories. And thank you for everyone who called in with questions and shared them via social media. We appreciate that. And thank you for having an open dialogue with us. Up next, we continue our Summer of Food series with Jeff Caruso. He's a chef for a local soup kitchen called A Meal and More. His interview with Evan Dawson is next on Connections.